I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today, the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. Are you ready to win at the game of life? Well, throw out that rule book and get down to the business of being the best and most authentic version of you. Welcome to the Human Design Podcast. We're changing the rules around success, abundance, purpose, love, and life, where we're creating a planet where everyone can thrive in a world that loves and supports each other. I'm your host, Emma Dunwoody, a qualified master coach, human design expert, podcaster, and entrepreneur that is living the life of my dreams, breaking all the rules while doing it, making a huge impact, and living my design and manifesting miracles on the daily. Join me as I break down and simplify everything you need to live in alignment with your human design, teach you how to recondition your unconscious mind for greatness, and to take back your power so you can manifest your heaven on earth and serve the rest of the planet at the same time. It's time to give up the fear and step into your highest potential, to reach for the stars, to know and live your greatness. It's what you deserve, and it's what the planet really needs from you. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Hey, hey, everyone, and welcome to today's episode. Well, for those of you that follow me on social media, you probably realize that not so long ago, I went on a meditation retreat to learn Vedic meditation. And of course, I did that with the amazing Gary Goro. Welcome to the podcast, Gary.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on your little show.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm excited to have you because I feel like you're one of those names that has been in my awareness for so long. You know, it's always cool when you see an Aussie that's sort of having an impact globally. So I've kind of been following along, and it was almost weird when, you know, the first session that we sat in, I'm like, wow, that's Gary Goro. It was really cool. But you're just so normal. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally normal.
So one of the things I love to open the show with is this question of like this moment in life. And many of us, you know, like me, we have many of these moments that might be like a dark night of the soul or a moment in time, usually when we're maybe in our 20s, where all of a sudden we get a diagnosis or something crappy happens. And in that moment, we're like, okay, hang on a second. I've got to do something about this. I can't accept what other people are telling me, or I need to make a significant change. And that moment becomes a catalyst for our purpose. It's something that sends us on our own hero's journey to become someone, to create something and to give that back to the world. And I'd really love to hear a bit about your journey of, you know, what was that catalyst for you and how did it send you on this journey to really just focus on meditation, which seems so freaking simple. We've got lots of sort of entrepreneurs listening here, and to be a meditation teacher that focuses just on that, it's like that's simple and beautiful and effortless. So tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, so depends how far back we want to go, but I guess the reason I got into meditation is because I was really burned out, stressed out, and miserable at the time. I'd tried meditation many years before, just at the end of yoga classes. And to be honest, I didn't enjoy it at all. I found it really difficult and I couldn't wait for that part to be over. And my brother, though, we were going to classes together, he seemed to love that part the most. So he was intrigued by the concept of meditation, and he ended up sort of pursuing it in private. And then when I really got to my nadir point, I was looking for answers. I was so lost in myself, and I said to him, "You don't seem to have the same struggles that I do, even though we're in the same family. What makes you different?" And he said, I'll tell you, I've been meditating. I've learned it over a year ago and I've kept it secret. And so I said, okay, it's time to share the secret. And then I went off and learned, and what it did for him, it did for me. It really just changed my whole life overnight. It was such a profound and immediate shift. And I'd just realized it's like fruit, you know. We have that idea of ripe fruit. When fruit's ripe, you just sort of touch the branch and it falls into your hand. Whereas if it's not ready, you can pull at it and it just will have this natural resistance. So I think everyone in their own time ripens, is ready. And just at that age of 21 when I learned, I was just like, it was perfect timing for me.
Yeah, wow. I love that metaphor of the fruit. Holy crap. Like, Because for me specifically, like my journey, I was diagnosed at 28 with depression and panic disorder, and it just and was given a diagnosis that I'd have to learn to manage it, but I would never be healed from it, and that just wasn't an option for me. And you know, as the listeners have heard a lot here, one of the very specific things I did was I started meditating. And when I first started, and it seems almost weird now, I think I've sometimes shared this story and thought, God, do people think I'm weird? But like when I first started meditating, I was scared. Like I was dead set scared to shut my eyes. I was so afraid of what I was going to see in there. Like there was like the stories that my brain had concocted, like even like I was going to be overrun by evil spirits and things. Like it was everything. I had everything going on in there, but I was like, I have to fix this thing. So I just sat there every single day and just did it. Is that like, do you ever hear that in other people that they're almost afraid of closing their eyes and being that present with their own mind?
You get different variants of that. One story comes to mind. There was this guy I know, and when I first started, I was very much, you know, surrounded by the party scene. That stage of life, it's kind of what everyone was doing, drinking, partying, chasing boys or girls and wild times. And so when I, at the age of 21, said, well, I just don't really have too much care for doing that anymore. A lot of my friends thought I'd just gone completely crackers. And then as I continued on my path, they kind of saw it was doing a lot of good for me. And then some of them jumped ship and whatnot. But there was one guy, he would say, you know, Gaz, I don't know about that meditation thing. Like when you sit there, like you were saying, evil spirits come into you. And I just sort of openly laughed out loud. And I said, are you serious? He goes, yeah, yeah. Because he'd somehow gotten that idea from his parents, from his religion or his belief system. And I was thinking, meanwhile, you're going out literally almost like every weekend without fail, taking copious amounts of cocaine, other drugs and alcohol, and you're worried that sitting there and meditating is going to be dangerous to your health. So I don't know. There's most of the stuff that confronts people is just that ability just to be still and to sit with themselves. Like most people are strangers to themselves. And to be able to get intimate with just your own inner space, it can be a little bit unnerving for people. But then anyone who's actually done it successfully and, you know, has a good method or technique, you realize, oh, my God, that's where the kingdom of heaven is. It's in that state of, you know, that bliss within us.
Yeah, oh, my God, that's so true. And I'm going to talk more to that because, you know, my journey with meditation has been 20 years and then doing Vedic meditation, which I'd love to talk about specifically, has been a real game changer. You know, there is that whole piece where I said to a friend of mine, in fact, a friend of mine that you met, she's one of the owners of Strong. I was talking to Sammy about the weekend and she's like, that's so weird because he was just in the other morning. And, you know, we were talking about how it was so effortless and easy. But I was saying, you know, the thing is that, you know, we live in a quantum reality and sitting in that space with you being a world-class meditator, I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm surfing his wave at this point. I'm pretty sure. And it's like that week the week since I was there, actually starting to put it into real life. Like a couple of them have been epic. And then there's been some not so epic, but I really want to get into that because a lot of what you taught us at that weekend was a game changer for the not so epic meditations. But before we do, I want to talk about Vedic meditation. You know, it's something that I've kind of been really curious about for a long time. And there's actually within human design, and I know you know nothing about human design, but obviously the listeners do, there is some specific what we call definition where a certain percentage of the global population have this mind that never shuts off. It's actually the way they're designed. It's like it's constantly running zeros and ones in the background. And for many years, I've been asking my clients to try meditation with a mantra, whatever that is, because my theory was that if you give the dog a bone, then potentially you can then meditate better. It was just, you know, no expertise whatsoever, just something that I've experimented with my clients and they've got a lot of success from it. However, you know, I've always been fascinated of this, the difference of using a mantra. Now, I did read a book by a very well-known person that uses a mantra, and that kind of worked for a while, but it didn't have the same effect. So I would love to hear, as you're the expert, what is Vedic meditation? And then let's start talking about these mantras because I thought it was fascinating that
straight away you're like, well, it doesn't mean anything. And I was like, wow, you just set me free. So can we first just get clear on what specifically is Vedic meditation?
Okay, so it's a practice that derives from ancient India. It comes from that continent and from the hands of these very ancient sages. It's between 5,000 and 10,000 years old, and it's been passed down orally through a particular lineage. And it arrived in the Western world back in like the 60s at the hands of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He was the founder of the Transcendental Meditation Movement. So the technique itself, it's what makes it distinct is its effortlessness, its simplicity, and anyone can do it. You know, there's not a human being on the planet that you couldn't put in front of me that I would fail to teach to meditate. You know, our whole nervous system, the body mind was designed and created to experience the meditative state. But sometimes the methods of getting there run counter to the way our system works, so it can be quite arduous and difficult. But everyone has the capacity to speak. You know, anyone in this listening to this cast could speak any human language. It's just you grow up in a culture, and because of that culture, you speak the language of that culture. For us, it's English, whereas if you grew up in, you know, France, you'd be speaking French. If you grew up in Chile, you'd be speaking Spanish. So in our culture, we don't really have much history of transcendence. We don't know how to get into meditative states because it's not what was honored by the culture, not what was held in esteem or high regard. So that's why we have to go to these ancient cultures that have a different orientation, where they really cherished consciousness states and inner expansion and development, not just solely external development or expansion. So I think, they in ancient India, they seem to understand the deeper realities to life. There's a heavily enlightened culture, and they've just enshrined certain values which are still extant today, just the inclusion of the divine aspect in the material. So the spiritual and the worldly are holding hands in that culture, whereas they're often at odds in other cultures. So, we borrow this practice from that beautiful legacy.
I love it. a large part of human design is like these ancient wisdoms. And I feel that, you know, we're in this time right now where we're in huge transition. And I think it's fascinating that anywhere where we spend some time getting curious about these more ancient wisdoms, we're like, wow, I had the answers. Here we are all running around smacking into each other, and really all the answers are right here in front of us. So, do you know, the question that I meant to ask you all weekend was like, how do you know which mantra to give which person? Or is it just a run sheet where you go, oh, you're next and you get this one? Like, how does that work? Is it you're intuitively given the mantra for each person, or how does that work?
Yeah, I guess there's some insider knowledge. So when you think of like the whole concept and science of mantras, meditation, these different lineages, how has something been able to exist for not hundreds of years, yet thousands? When you look in most cultures, things get outdated now in a matter of years. You know, the apps that we're running on our phones, they'll be gone in 5 years, 10, you know, if you're lucky. Yeah. So the way that, you know, certain things are preserved is they're cherished and held sacred, and some things are held private. So when you look at the science of mantras, which you were mentioning earlier, there's hundreds of thousands of different mantras in the Vedic tradition, and some of them are in the public domain and some are in the private domain. And so mantras in the public domain can be shared and utilized and written down and given out easily, and, you know, sometimes people use them in yoga classes, they're written in books and all sorts of things like that. And then there are these series of really sacred sounds which are safeguarded and held close to the teacher, and also when someone is initiated, also it's kept private and personal. And that's really just to maintain the efficacy, safeguard the tradition, and keep the practice alive. So there's some things that I'm not able to answer by virtue of that lineage, you know, keeping things sacred. But if you want to keep digging into the mantras and why do they work, how did they come about? when you start looking into Vedic culture, you see how advanced it was. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, we look into these ancient cultures and we kind of think they were a bit primitive. And then actually the more you pull back the veil, you're like, holy moly, they were so advanced.
Yeah.
So tuned in. They may not have had the technologies like, you know, a smartphone, but they had many other things. You know, they were using the potential of their consciousness and tapping into higher and higher realities. So it was said that the sages had supersensory perception. They would experience the world through a different filter or through a different lens, and they would perceive the world as vibration of sound, and there'd be a deep felt sense of things. And so a lot of the Vedic wisdom was cognized. This is a fascinating concept that when, you know, you say, who's the author of this? They will say it's unauthored knowledge. Mm-hmm. There was no author. It's declared to be apurashaya, which basically means, you know, no known human author. What there was individuals who were fully awake in their awareness, and then they were able to download and receive that information. So the knowledge was cognized, was delivered, or basically picked up from their state of realization. And so the sounds came through them. They were gifted this knowledge. Mm. In the same way, I was fascinated once when an Indigenous Australian woman was, you know, telling people, you know, that we use this plant for this ailment and this one for this. And then this Westerner was like, how do you know that they do that? How did you guys ever figure that out? And she looked at him very curiously and said, the plants told us.
Yeah.
And the same thing in Ayurveda, like there's this whole intelligence and even shamanic wisdom that these plants are living beings. Everything is living intelligence. And when your consciousness is awake, you can commune with that intelligence. And then you can start to gain insights that you wouldn't otherwise gain. And so the sages were in their enlightened states, were able to cognize a whole host of knowledge and information, the mantras being, you know, one aspect of that. And they were known that there were certain sounds, you know, sound and matter are correlated because, as Einstein said, energy equals mc squared. So you have energy on one side and you have matter moving at the speed of light on the other side of the equation, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So when you look at energy, it's really sound. And it's energy moving at specific vibrations. So we can make random sounds just now as we are with our language, but there are specific sounds that have a more potent effect on the field of creation, on the field of form. So they're known that there are certain mantras that pull the strings of creation. Mm. And when you look at the mantras we're using when we meditate, they're pulling the strings of the nervous system. They're leading us into more of a coherent, expanded state of awareness. So it's really helping the brain cycle down and go into an enriched mode, or turning certain parts of the brain off and turning other parts, you know, upregulating other parts. Yeah. So these sounds seem to have this effect on the nervous system.
Yeah.
And but obviously there's a lot more to it than that, which is why I'll often say to people, if all you needed was a mantra, you know, the course of learning meditation with them would be like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But as you know, you spent, you know, almost 90-minute to 2-hour sessions each time, and then you come away out with a deep, rich understanding, and then you're really established in the science of it, and then you've got confidence and self-sufficiency really established. Mm-hmm. So the thing about these traditions is often there's this concept of Shaktipat, which you sort of touched on earlier, but Shaktipat is like, Shakti is the energy or power that exists in everybody.
Yeah.
And Shaktipat is when there's a transference of that power from one source to another. So often in the presence of a guru, you can receive initiation through Shaktipat, which is basically just a transmission from one to another. And it can be directed just with the mind, or you can use, you know, your hands or whatever it may be. So there's also within the way in which someone receives a mantra, I just don't give it to you now. There's a ceremony that needs to be performed first.
Yeah.
And that ceremony honors the lineage, it calls them in, and it gives it sort of charges the teacher up with a certain energy and frequency, and then they're in a position to then deliver that mantra. Because without that, it's said to be like a seed that just doesn't have any intelligence in it. You know, it needs to be infused with the ceremonial aspect. And for some people, you know, hearing that, they might go, that sounds a bit woo-woo and weird.
Not for this audience.
It just seems to me there's a lot more to reality than we, you know, we consider and that we're tapping into. Yeah. So the ceremonial aspect's really important. And often, you know, things aren't taught until there's something of that nature which is done. One, because it creates the energy, the atmosphere. It also makes it distinct in that person's awareness that this is something really important that I'm engaging in right now. So it's not very trivial, you know. Something was written on a toilet door and, you know, and you go to the bathroom and you see it written, like how much value are you going to place on it?
Exactly. And it's interesting, that's the word that kept coming up. It's like the value, and it's this I think the ceremony as well. I know for me, as I was sort of standing there in the first session, I'm like, you know, this is important. You know, be with this, be present with this. And it's, you know, as you were speaking, one of the things I thought was fascinating that popped into my head, like I see patterns, all sorts of crazy ass patterns. But as you were speaking, I was thinking about one of the things that I'm fascinated with is free electricity. Now, we know ever since Tesla, we know this thing exists. Every time it's kind of invented, we know it's not invented, but some person says, right, okay, I've invented this thing. It somehow, poof, disappears. Now, one of the people that's pretty vocal on this, Dr. Stephen Greer, he always talks like the moment this will change is the moment when people open source. And I think like that's exactly what you're saying, but in our modern society, like we need to get our egos out of the way and we need to open source this wisdom so that, you know, everyone can really receive it. And I feel like that's a big part of this experience with the Vedic meditation. Like, as I said, I learned to meditate 20 years ago and I've been pretty good. Like I've got, you know, there would not be a week that I didn't meditate 3 or 4 times, and most days I would have done it over that time. But what I'm really fascinated by is for someone who's done that all of these years, and I'm certainly no expert. I do not profess to be an expert. Like sometimes it's just like sitting still for 20 minutes because nothing else is still. And the thing that I think is really fascinating, and as you were speaking, I'm like, wow, that's why it's so powerful, is because we live in a quantum reality. So when we commit to something that has a lineage, that has an ancient wisdom so deep, every time we're tapping in, so every time my mantra is present with me, it's like I'm plugging into that lineage, and that's what's helping me do this thing, which kind of answers one of my questions. But obviously you're the expert, so I want to hear from you, is that the thing that blew my mind is that I've been in the meditation gym for 22 years. I am, sorry, 20 years. I am, as I said, I'm not an expert. I don't profess to be an expert. However, the specific difference was very big, you know, like the ease of it, the speed, you know, of dropping in, like all of these things and the way, and I don't know how much you can share, but I would really love to hear about the ease. Because it's something in meditation, you know, people say to me all the time, like, well, because it's probably one of the first tips that I give any of my clients, like, that's the thing you want to do. Do the thing that works for you, but meditate. Like, it can be easy. It can be effortless. You can do these things. And sometimes it's not, but it's not wrong. And I think that was the other piece, is like understanding that it's not wrong when it's not easy, effortless, and still. So I feel like it's a really big open-ended question. However, I'm pretty confident you know how to respond. I'm pretty sure I'm like the 50 millionth person that's asked you this. But can we talk about the simplicity a little bit, the ease, and when it's not so easy, that doesn't mean it's broken.
Yeah. Yeah, I've noticed that the tendency with the Western mind is to complicate things. Mm. Like you look at health, for example, you know, people are starting to look at the molecular level and the biological levels of things, and rather than just eat well, sleep well, exercise, get fresh air and things like that. Like things can get so, you know, myopic, and you get so tangled up in the minutiae, and that tends to be what we're good at. You know, we create these wonderful leagues and leagues of complexity. Whereas when you look at what meditation is attempting to do, it's really the ultimate goal of meditation is to ground yourself in your own being. Basically transition away from that active thinking domain of your mind into that more transcendent value of you, which is your presence, your awareness, your fundamental self, your inner being, consciousness, spirit, whatever you want to call it. And so the mind seems to be the greatest obstruction to our being able to access that domain. So when you look at what most people do when they meditate, when you haven't been initiated, you don't have a really good technique or method, the mind is just so overactive that you're just tangled up in that and you can't ever escape it and get into that subtler place. So what the sages did is they created a system and a method that works every time, where you connect your mind with the mantra. And the thing about these mantras is they're self-refining sounds. So they're designed to go in the inward direction. They're designed to go to the deepest place in you. Not all mantras obviously do that. You know, some create a lot of energy, some create focus, some are invoking the divine feminine or millions of other qualities. So when we're doing Vedic meditation, we're utilizing sounds which by their nature goes to the depths in you, like throwing a stone into the ocean. It only knows to sink. It doesn't know how to float. So these have a particular type of gravity that takes the mind inward as the mind connects with it. So the mantra is really doing the work for you. So meditation, every time you do it, it should be effortless. It might not always be transcendental, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a second, but sometimes your meditations can feel busy, active, your mind feels a little bit thought-filled, but nonetheless, our approach is effortless every time. Because what you learn within the art of meditating is just to go with the natural pulsations and flows within the practice itself. And sometimes there might be lots of activity and movement, and other times there'll be lots of time spent in that deep stillness and silence. But why I like to mention to people why we're engaging in the practice of meditation is for the uplift it brings in our waking state. So you end up as a meditator developing this non-attachment to what happens when you're sitting there meditating each day, not trying to achieve anything, be good at it or master this or that. You're just wanting to be effortless. And, of course, each time you sit, there's going to be certain internal weather patterns that are going to influence how you experience that little journey. But nonetheless, each time you exit out, you've given this massive upgrade to your body and mind, and you've taken yourself into an altered state for a period of time, and then that state starts to influence and speak to you, your waking mode.
This is your monthly reminder to go to the show notes and check out the Body Graph Chart software. I know you've heard us talk about this before, so I'll keep this very short and very sweet. But if you want to know the tool that we've used to bring in over 20,000 new leads and five figures in passive revenue into our business, then go check it out. It's amazing. Stop sending people away to other people's websites to get their human design chart. Instead, use this tool to put it on your own website. You won't regret it. And use the code Human Design Podcast, all lowercase, all together, Human Design Podcast, to get 50% off for a year.
Yeah. I love it. Just as an aside, because I wear an Aura ring, do you know one of the things that has been brilliant is ever since I did the retreat, my HRV, it has my heart rate variability, for those people that don't know what I'm talking about. It's healthier the further it goes up, and it's just shot up. So it's like, for me, I'm like, the evidence is in the numbers. Like, I love it. And, you know, one of the things that you said that I loved is like, it doesn't need to be perfect. I mean, I'm not a perfectionist. I was raised by a perfectionist, but I just, to be honest, fuck everything up the first time. So I'm so far from being a perfectionist. However, I loved that you were like, you don't need to be perfect at it, and you can do it anywhere. And in the week and a bit that I've been doing it, I've done it on a plane, I've done it in the hotel, I've done it actually, I was having red light therapy, so I actually sat down for that one with my red, in this room with all the red lights, like I did it then. So it's just been so incredibly powerful and yet so simple. And I really want to talk about the stress, because we live in this world right now where we are so heavily stressed. And I think it is because we're stuck in the minutia. Everyone's trying to sort of hustle and strive, especially those sort of listening to this podcast. And actually there's two things given my listeners is one of the things that we're all really kind of learning to surrender to, because there's a lot of people that have been in the hustle, that they want to achieve, they want to make an impact, that listen to this podcast. However, we all know that there's a better way, and this better way is really learning who we are authentically on the inside, and then bringing, you know, having the courage to actually be that in our reality. So I'd just love to really talk a little bit about one of the things that we're learning to balance is, well, are we out of our comfort zone or are we out of alignment? Because there's a lot in, you know, this podcast, we do live in the spiritual world as well as the education or the personal development world. And there's a lot of spiritual development where people are like, well, if it doesn't feel good, don't do it. And a lot of human design teachers that teach that, and I specifically don't. I'm like, well, I'm also a behavioralist, and if it feels uncomfortable, then in many cases that's a good thing because the brain is growing. We're outside our comfort zone. So the thing I also thought was so incredibly powerful and got me across the line to meditate 2 times a day was how you spoke about stress and how Vedic meditation helps us release the stress and trauma, because in many cases trauma is just trapped emotion that we didn't have the opportunity to feel in the moment. So our body keeps reminding us like we need to process this emotion. So about how we process that emotion and the difference between the one and the two, like understanding that in modern society, it's a good chance that we have this stress deficit that sits in our body. So do you want to talk a little bit about how powerful this meditation is for not only releasing the stress in the moment, but the stress deficit that sits in our bodies?
Yeah, so we could say stress, there's many aspects to stress, but essentially stress is when we get overwhelmed and we maladapt to a situation and then we go into a fight or flight state, or sometimes it's called fight, flight, freeze or fawn. And essentially that is when we're waking up a very primitive response that served us very well back in the day when we lived in predatory environments, when we didn't have Woolworths and Uber and police, you know, that we could just call up and protect us and things like that. So as a species, we had to summon enormous amount of energy and focus and resources to get the food or not become the food, essentially. And so this was once a life-saving response, and I would say a human being would genuinely need that in their life, maybe 5-10 times in a lifetime. Maybe when your house is getting broken into, or you're getting carjacked, or someone's trying to assault you, or something like that. But the thing about that fight or flight response is we're invoking it in situations just where we're annoyed. Can't find our keys, we're getting caught in traffic, or we're getting overwhelmed, our inbox is a bit burdening, or someone is a little bit short with us, or a coworker is getting on our nerves, whatever it may be. So anytime you overreact or maladapt to a situation, you invoke the fight or flight response in that moment. So a whole series of things happen within the brain and the physiology, which is basically preparing you to basically protect yourself. You go into this mode of protection. Your neocortex, that more evolved creative part of your brain, gets bypassed and goes offline. Then you start to act via your more primitive limbic system. You know that your heart rate increases, adrenaline, noradrenaline, stress hormones move through the body. Fats and sugars go into the bloodstream, give you more energy. Your blood coagulates, it gets drained by your vital organs, goes into your arms and legs. Basically, so you can run and you can fight. And you're mobilizing this intense energy in 1/100 of a second, so you can just be alert, be on guard and survive. But the thing about that is your brain and body don't really know the difference between the bear that's chasing you or the fact that, you know, you're running late for work and you're not going to be there until 15 minutes after. And you can have the exact same physiological response, the same stress hormones in your system from both those things. And so what happens in our daily life, which is pretty understandable, our world is very information rich. We're heavily stimulated. There's enormous amount of pressure. It's a highly competitive culture. We live in nuclear families. We're all pitted against one another. We're not in tribes where there's this harmony and this mutual sharing and care and concern. Most people carry, you know, they're living on the precipice where interest rates go up. They have to start, you know, considering certain things. Like, we have this bear that's chasing us psychologically quite a lot of the time. Yeah. And anytime you get stressed, there's a reaction you have in that moment, but then there's the memory that lives on in the body from the response in that moment. And I often use the analogy, like, say someone can't find their keys, and then they know they really need to be at this appointment, and then they're starting to get more and more panicked as they're turning the house upside down trying to find their keys. And then finally, you know, after, you know, screaming at everyone and rallying the whole house to, you know, turn every pocket out, inside out, and look under every couch and everything like that, they realize, oh, I left the keys in the car. Yeah. And then the person goes and gets in the car and then goes to where they need to be. They get there and all's forgotten. All's well, no problem. But we often forget, what about the charge from that moment? What happens to that? So typically your body will process and diffuse it in normal circumstances. You know, the way we reset our bodily organism is through sleep. That's what we donate a third of our life to, because it does this wonderful healing and upgrading to our system. However, what tends to happen now in the modern world is we're being exposed to so much information, stimulation, pressure, and we're having so many stress responses in a day that sleep gets burdened and overwhelmed. And so the quality of our sleep goes down, and we're not releasing all of the stresses from that day from our system. So we end up beginning day two with a residual amount from the previous day. And at the end of that day, we've accumulated a certain volume of stresses in our system, and then we sleep at that night. And, of course, we don't release all of it. So there's this accumulation day after day, week after week, month after month, year on year, decade after decade. So we start to notice that our consciousness potential starts to feel the weight of that, and our emotional buoyancy and the, you know, the love in our hearts and the joy we have as children, you notice that light gets a little dimmer and dimmer as we start to progress further down the timeline of being a human being. Mm-hmm. And you think, how is it we can go from these joyful children who are just in love with everything to being these adults that are now on medication and anxious and depressed because life's just too hard? So it's not so much that it's life, but it's how we process life. And we're not all trained well. We don't have good self-regulation skills. We don't have techniques, and we don't have ways to reset and rewrite our code each and every day. So it's natural that life starts to sort of burden us, and it gets, you know, the upper hand, and we start to notice we're a shadow of our best self. And so we need to find ways and means in which we can clear those stresses and that inventory of stress out each day. That's why one meditation seems to eliminate the stress from that day, but it doesn't do much about the inventory. So a second one starts to rapidly dissolve and eat into that. So you could say that one is sort of has a maintenance effect. Life's definitely not pushing you back. You're moving a little bit forward, but the stresses, you're kind of balancing them. Whereas two is game changing. And in my field, when I've taught people who have done it once, and they've chosen to do it once a day, the instruction is do it 20 minutes morning and afternoon or night. I've noticed a complete difference between those that do it once and those that do it twice. It's almost like they're doing something completely different, like a totally different practice.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating. And I mean, I hear all the time, I don't have time for meditation. You know, simply, how do you answer that?
Well, with the meditator's joke, if you don't have time to meditate for 20 minutes, you better do it for an hour. And the other thing is, you just look at the numbers, like how many minutes are there in a day? We've got 1,440. So all you're being really asked to do is set aside 40.
Yeah.
You've still got 1,400. That is significant. And when you look at the return on the investment you get from each one of those sittings, as your aura room would tell you, you get into a state that is several times deeper than the deepest point of rest you get in a night's sleep. So it's massively restorative for your system. When you look at it, you know, at a really macroscopic level, you look at the telomeres, which are the end caps on the DNA. Stress has been shown to run those down and make them shorter. And meditation has actually been shown to increase the length of the telomeres and make them thicker and more robust. And this is like cellular death. Once a cell multiplies and divides a certain number of times, those telomeres wear out and it just goes, well, we're done. So there's this longevity aspect that meditation, just by, you know, taking your consciousness into this expanded mode each day, it's so profoundly healing for your body. And the studies have shown it actually reverses the biological aging, which is quite remarkable in this day and age.
How old are you, Gary?
Chronologically or biologically?
Both, because I'm tipping you certainly don't look how old you are. I don't know how old you are, but I'm guessing that I'll be surprised.
Yeah, I'm 46.
Yeah, right. Oh my God.
Yeah. Nice one. Biologically, I've never done the test. I'd be curious to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to do it too. Like, because I'm just about to turn 49. So I'm like, right. Mm. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I want to, there's a couple of things. I'm very conscious of your time. One of the things personally that I'm so curious about is someone who, I want to talk about this word transcendence. You're like, I'll come back to that. I want to talk about that. But for me personally, I'm so curious what your life, your lived experience must be like. You told a story at the dinner table about creating Soma. And if people out there, if you've not seen Soma, it's freaking beautiful. Even if I get most of you are in the States, it's okay. If you come to Australia, you've got to go. And even if you haven't, you can see it on an awesome show called Nine Perfect Strangers on Netflix. Look it up. It's stunning. But you were telling this story about how when you and your family were designing the place and building the place, how there was a part of you, because in the Vedic tradition there is, you know, your version of feng shui, and there was this part of you was like, wow, I just don't want to go down that rabbit hole, so I'm just going to kind of follow. I don't think you used the word intuition, but that's the word I heard. And then quite by accident almost, someone who understood this feng shui of Vedic meditation saw and went, how did you, this was, it's spot on. So that just made me think, like, is that what your life is like? Like, you just kind of move through, you're present in the moment, you're just responding to life. Like, and somewhere can you like talk about transcendence? Because, you know, the moment I sat in that room and you said that word, I'm like, I want to go there. I want that. I want to be being, you know, like my whole body wanted to go there. And my meditations were deeper than they've ever been, especially for the last few years. And the reason I was there was because they were just really busy and I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. So just to give you guys some context. But, yeah, can you talk a little about your lived experience, all these years being so deep, connected to you, and how even you don't need, it's almost like you don't need someone to map, shit out for you because it's already coming through you. Can you talk a little bit to that, please?
Yeah, I think like I'm like everyone else. I'm part of this big school of life, this big, you know, this game, this play, this leela, this sport that we're all enjoying. Yeah. And one thing I used to think was the more your consciousness becomes enhanced, the smoother the ride becomes. And that is true to an extent. Your capacity to handle the challenges of life definitely increases. Yeah. But it doesn't mean the challenges cease. And if anything, they often increase. You know, greater the capability, the greater the challenge. Otherwise, you know, nature's not building the muscle of wisdom. So I still find, like everyone, I get thrown challenges, situations. Life is full of problems or invitations, as you can prefer to think of them. You know, so I've gotten pretty good at like playing the game and using. You know, obviously I'm established, you know, 25 or so years in a practice. So that's opened up a dimension in me, which means that I have, you know, a lot of stillness and grace and equanimity on hand. But I also have, you know, a human mind and I live in a human world and I have a human physiology. And like everyone else, life just continues to challenge and do its thing. So I think I rely heavily on my intuition and I feel like I'm a really deep feeler. So I'll tend to just...
I wish we had your design. Oh, my God. I would love to see it.
I really like to marry like the mind, the intellect and understanding with a felt sense and a connection. Yeah. So that tends to be how I operate. And when I do that, it's a really good way to navigate through all the storms and challenges and obstacles and things. Because sometimes something can feel really alluring to the intellect or mind or the ego. But in another level, if you checked in, you'd be like, actually, that just doesn't feel quite right. Yeah. So I'll like tend to make these alignments happen before I do anything, or I'll lean into the thing that feels right rather than what looks right or the data is right or the numbers add up or whatever. I've never lived that way. So my preference is just to like navigate through the subtle territory, you know, using different apparatus, you know, using the heart, using your intuition, using that deeper knowing. And they both definitely have a place. So with the house, you know, that was That was a big conspiracy, universal conspiracy, just to make make it a magic. And so I often say I was really the midwife, just helping bring a certain, flavor and accent to it. And I feel very grateful to have been given, that precious responsibility, and still to this day, being there just as the spiritual guide for, the decisions we make and where we take this place and what we open up to.
Yeah.
But it's a big undertaking, and like anything that is significant, it draws out a lot. And meditation, I think, gives you the access to transcend, which means to go beyond your mind, go beyond the world, go beyond the world of form and stuff and matter and issues and deadlines and finances and all of that stuff, all that we swim in and all that our senses are tangled up in every day. And you go into this other place, which is that kingdom of heaven, or that field of stillness or unboundedness, or what we refer to in Vedic vernacular as the self or the absolute. Mm-hmm. And so in tapping into the absolute each day, that absolute starts to become your primary self, as opposed to this undiscovered or unmet or unknown self. Mm-hmm. And so as you start to tap into that supreme inner being, it starts to infuse itself, and it starts to become the thing which you're more identified with than your ego self, your mind stuff, your position in life and all of that.
Yeah.
So I think I'm just very fortunate that I was introduced to that, so many years ago, and it's just become more and more a part of how I measure myself and feel and where I operate from is just from that deeper place in me.
I love that. I love that. And I think, especially to, also from a mother's perspective, I have two sons, every time I hear men speak that way, like it's important to come from my heart and be authentic and trust my intuition. I think it's so incredibly important because, the divine feminine is rising in all of us, not just women, men and women. And it's so beautiful to hear, and to see that you've had such success and have that imbalance, it's heart success, or what I would call authentic success, versus ego success, that masculine achieve. So, oh my God, Gary, I've got like 50,000 other questions, but I got to let you go. I got to respect your time. How can people learn more about you? I mean, I was just looking. I've actually, one of the other attendants of the retreat and I, we've become accountability buddies because I'm like, I want to make sure that I make this a habit. And we both wanted to come to the next one, but we're both traveling to do the next step up. And so do you only do one retreat of the intro and then one advanced each year? Is that it? Don't tell me that's it.
Yeah, no, we've got a few different flavors. So we do a bunch of different meditation retreats, and then we do a rounding retreat, a couple of times a year. And then there's also a yoga philosophy, yoga practices, pranayama, breathwork, kriyas, and obviously the asana aspect. So we do offer different sort of varieties and flavors and dynamics on the retreats. So I guess the best one for you to do would be do the rounding one, which is a real wonderful advancement of what you've already got.
Amazing. I feel like I just want to go to all of them, even just to sit next to the pool and look at that view, like that tree down in that paddock. And you were saying that you cleared the whole paddock, but whoever cleared it had the foresight to leave that stunning tree. Like, that's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Life's the grand orchestrator. If we just listen, then we end up exactly where we need to be. It's just mastering the art of being receptive, I think.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I think that's beautiful. Let's leave it at that. Where can people find you, Gary? Website, Instagram? How can people find out more about Gary Goro?
Well, I think probably on Instagram. I have to say that I'm probably like one of the worst people at promoting and doing all of that. So, but on Instagram is the best place to get me these days. Just at Gary Goro. Yeah.
Love it. Brilliant. We'll put all the links. We'll also put the link for Soma. Even if you're not in Australia, I highly encourage you. It's a full experience. So if you come in this way or you want to have an adventure, go check out Soma as well, because it's beautiful. Thanks again, Gary. This has been brilliant. Lovely to talk to you.
And thanks for the time.
Oh, so good. And thank you everyone for listening. I trust you got what you needed from today's episode, and I look forward to having you on the next one. Bye for now. Thanks everyone for being here all the way to the end of the podcast. I hope you got lots of value out of it. I certainly had a lot of fun doing it. Could I please ask that you share this podcast with friends if you found it valuable? And also, bonus points, could you leave a review for me as well on Apple? It would be greatly appreciated. If at any point you would like to be on the podcast or you've got questions that you'd like me to discuss on the podcast, by all means, get on my socials and DM me. Everything you need is there in the show notes. Have an awesome day. Bye for now.